It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I always joke that Daniel Craig should send the Kennedy estate a thank you note for having helped to make the Bond franchise into the international behemoth that it is today.
Welcome to One Day University. Talks with the world's most engaging and inspiring professors discussing their most popular courses. This podcast is your chance to discover some of our top-rated lectures on your own schedule. I'm Stephen Schragis, and we've put together some presidential recommended reads. American leaders of the past and present have appreciated a variety of literature, everything from plays to poetry to spy thrillers. But do their reading habits give us any sense of their strength as a leader? Professor Joseph Luzzi explores this in a one-day university lecture titled The President's Book Club. He's a professor of comparative literature at Bard College, and he's written books covering topics from Dante to Italian cinema. Joseph says the idea for this talk came to him while he was studying dystopian literature.
A few years ago, I taught a course on banned and censored books. And one thing I noticed was that in a lot of these dystopian worlds, one of the first things that the kind of powers that be would do, you see this in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, you see it in Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, is that they would ban books. And I thought, you know, how interesting and sinister that when a government becomes averse to freedom, it also becomes averse to books and learning. And I thought, well, that's a connection I wanted to explore more. And then I would say the tipping point was there was this article in The Economist that I read shortly before kind of putting the talk together, in which they talked about leadership and leadership training. But they said, you know, instead of corporate retreats, instead of how-to books by, you know, people in the business world, which of course have their validity, why not look to great literature for models? And I said, you know, I really want to dig into this topic and see how leaders themselves have approached the world of books. And that sort of got everything rolling.
You picked a pretty logical starting point, George Washington, obviously.
Yeah.
He was first.
Yeah.
But that said, George Washington wasn't really known to be a scholar. Tell us about George Washington and the book or the literary work that really seemed to influence him.
This is one of my favorite discoveries. I remember I went to a 4th of July reenactment with my family near my house, and we met the person who played George Washington, and we were talking with him, and we said, you know, what's one of your regrets in life, Mr. Washington? And he said, not having a college education. And you know, my family joke, well, you went pretty far in the world without one. But I think that image of George Washington as a man of action, not an intellectual. We associate John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, some of the earlier office holders of the presidency with a world of books. Not so much with George Washington. He was a general, he was a farmer, he was a statesman. Interestingly, though, I found that George Washington was very committed to the world of books. He designed his own book plate. He had quite a collection of books. And he also was a pretty passionate reader of one particular play. It's called Cato, C-A-T-O, by Joseph Addison from the early 1700s. So it's one of those works that hasn't stood the test of time, but in its time, its effect was profound. Not just George Washington, it was a play about Cato, the ancient Roman who resisted the tyranny of, you know, the death of the Roman Republic when Julius Caesar became tyrant and Cato took his own life in defense. And so he kind of became a symbol to the American revolutionaries. Allegedly, George Washington had the play performed at Valley Forge. He sprinkled his letters with references to it. But it wasn't just him. Patrick Henry's great speech, "Give me liberty or give me death," is lifted from Cato by Addison. Nathan Hale, the American patriot, when he said, "I regret that I have but one life to give to my country," that also comes from Joseph Addison's Cato. So it was an example of how a forgotten literary work could actually be in the DNA of American democracy. And that was a kind of thrilling discovery for me.
Before we move on to the next president, I have the word etiquette books written on my notes here. What's going on there?
Well, you know, George Washington had a particular genre of books that he was quite devoted to, and that was etiquette books. He loved to read etiquette books. He collected them. These were books that we think of Emily Post in the 20th century, these books that teach us how to gracefully accept or decline a dinner invitation. Or I imagine the updated version of Emily Post would be like how to gently unfriend someone on Facebook. Obviously, that wasn't something that George Washington thought about. But these kind of etiquette questions obsessed Washington, and I think it's in keeping with his image as someone who knew how politically to say and do the right thing, who took the quality of dignity and decorum very seriously, and sort of trained himself in the images of these early etiquette manuals.
Second up on deck is Thomas Jefferson. Now, this one's not a surprise. This is a man who all of us think of as a dedicated reader. You've done the research to document exactly why we think of Jefferson as a voracious reader, and that his thoughts were even reflected in the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, I mean, look, no surprise here. And, you know, Thomas Jefferson, who founded the University of Virginia, was considered a person of letters in his age, and his library reflected that a wide range of interests, including the fields like botany, winemaking, philosophy, history, and whatnot. So that's no surprise. I think what was a surprise to me was looking at the documents, say a very famous document, the Declaration of Independence. You think of a line by Jefferson, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." Now, that's a bit of a mouthful. It's a lot of 18th century political discourse, but I had been teaching in Bard's first year seminar program, and we were reading some of the founding figures of political philosophy. And two figures in particular that I'd been teaching, John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, I saw how their ideas were permeating Jefferson's writing in the Declaration of Independence. Let's take this notion of equality, for example, that Jefferson talks about. Now, one of the engines for that comes from John Locke's idea of the tabula rasa, which means the blank slate. This idea that, you know, all people are created equal, that no matter where you're born or when you're born, there's a kind of neutrality to human nature. And, you know, we take it for granted now. And of course, it wasn't expressed politically in the 18th century because the 18th century had terrible forms of inequality, including the evil of slavery. But as an idea that informed the Declaration of Independence, that idea of equality from Jefferson has to be informed by Locke's notion of the blank slate. And similarly, when Jefferson writes about that governments are instituted among men, deriving their powers from the consent of the governed, that idea of consent is so essential to social contract theory of the 18th century. And that's where thinkers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau were so important, where they basically came up with a model saying that when we enter in society through consent, we agree as a people to give up our individual rights in the name of the collectivity. That can only happen if we consent to do so. So you can see in just one densely written paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, you can see the swirling of intellectual currents from major thinkers like John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau.
We're going to jump forward a little onto Abraham Lincoln. Now, this is someone we all know of as a voracious reader, and we know of him as completely self-taught. What we don't know a lot about is his thoughts about Shakespeare. Can you discuss Abraham Lincoln's relationship to the Shakespearean tragedies, Hamlet and Macbeth?
So Lincoln loved Shakespeare. He carried Shakespeare with him. He quoted from the plays. He's on record for just showing how passionate he was about Shakespeare. But, you know, there was a little bit of surprise in Lincoln's devotion to Shakespeare. And I think it comes from what you said earlier, Stephen, about Lincoln as the kind of prototypical self-made man. Lincoln is one of those figures, becomes a lawyer by studying for the bar on his own. He grew up on dirt floors, the whole incredible rise of Lincoln. And I think that that backstory shaped the way he approached Shakespeare. For example, he said, you know, I don't care too much for the famous soliloquy of Hamlet, to be or not to be, because I think he didn't have that much in common with Hamlet. Hamlet was the prince of Denmark. He was to the manor born, as they say. Lincoln instead said he loved Macbeth, and he loved the speech in Hamlet where Claudius says, oh, my offense is rank, where he basically says, I know I'm guilty, but I'm not going to give up the crown. And it got me thinking about, you know, what was it about Lincoln and Shakespeare? And I think part of it had to do with Lincoln's moral brilliance, his conscience, the fact that, you know, he believed that the evil of slavery had to end. America went to war because of that. But he also felt the weight of all those deaths of Americans on his conscience. But where I think Shakespeare really drives Lincoln, think of a speech like the Second Inaugural Address. It's one of the most extraordinary speeches in American history, where Lincoln basically says, look, the North is basically going to win this war militarily, but ultimately it's a war in which both sides have lost, because both sides fighting were American. And so that speech is just this remarkable work of rhetoric when he says, all knew that, you know, the interest of slavery was the cause of the war. And then he said, neither party expected for the war the magnitude of the duration which is already attained. Neither anticipated, and he goes, you notice the repetition of neither there. Each looked for an easier triumph. Both read the same Bible. And then he says, in crushing that rhetorical crescendo, the prayers of both could not be answered. And then he says, but let us not judge, lest we be judged. It's an amazing, the use of the pronouns, the sort of all, both, neither, and then this kind of deflating sentiment at the end that this is a war that has taken so many lives. It's not the time to criticize, but it's a time to heal. And I think that that moral vision of Lincoln was nourished by his understanding of a writer like Shakespeare. Shakespeare was a brilliant student of human nature. And he understood that often our virtues are bound up in with our vices. And I think for Lincoln to think with and through Shakespeare's plays over his lifetime enabled him to cultivate his own moral vision that led to astonishing speeches like the Second Inaugural Address, where literally the fate of the United States and the Union was on the line. The stakes couldn't have been higher.
After the break, an inspirational poem for FDR and a spy thriller for JFK.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're going to go to FDR. And you've explained in your talk how one work in particular, Rudyard Kipling's poem If, is something that FDR carried with him his whole life, actually. You want to give us some detail on that?
As you know, I love tennis. And besides my fantasy to play at Wimbledon Center Court, which will never happen, every person who walks onto Center Court passes under a plaque with the lines, if you can meet victory and defeat and treat those two imposters the same. You know, that basically it's not about winning and losing, it's how you play the game. And that's a poem by Rudyard Kipling, who's much better known as the author of the Jungle Books. Now, that poem, If, became a kind of mantra for FDR. And it's a poem basically about overcoming obstacles, overcoming challenges, and holding your head high and not letting other people see you suffer. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth. and everything that's in it. And what is more, you'll be a man, my son. So that's just a brief citation from the poem. FDR was so drawn to this, and I think we can kind of understand why personally. As we all know, or any of us who spent any time thinking about FDR, he suffered from polio and he couldn't walk for most of his life. And Stephen, the way I think it's so fascinating is that politically, it's not like we can say, oh, he's citing if here, but I feel echoes of if in some of his greatest speeches. When in his first inaugural address, which I think is his greatest speech in 1932, we were in the midst of the Depression. It was the interwar period. Fascism was on the rise in Europe. This was not a good time in the world. The world was descending into darkness and it would end up in World War II. And Americans were starving. There were runs on banks. 90% of the stock market had gone down. At one point, he says in that first inaugural address, he says, in such a spirit on my part and yours, we face common difficulties. They concern, thank God, only material things. And I think that's the message that so many Americans needed to hear then, because the sense of despair and pessimism was so rampant. And here you had a man saying, we'll get through this. These are only material challenges. And I think a work like If, that poem, helped fuel Roosevelt's sense of resolve and ingenuity.
Jumping forward again, we're moving quickly now, all the way to JFK. Now, this is the only president who won a Pulitzer Prize, although, as you know, that's a somewhat controversial issue. Not necessarily going there. Even beyond that, though, one of his favorite books was about a British spy, a name we all know. You want to tell us about that, Joe?
Kennedy's really interesting. Yes, you know, he does win a Pulitzer. There's a lot of controversy around it because there's the talk that he got help writing it, et cetera, et cetera. Bracketing that, we can say one thing about John F. Kennedy. His love of literature was genuine. I mean, he loved to read. In fact, early in his career, his dream, in some part, was to be a writer. And he was seriously committed to the world of books. And he was a writer. He did write throughout his life. So there was a more playful aspect to his love of literature, being a president and having access to the corridors of power, proverbial and literal. He got to meet people like spies and former spies. And one of them that he met was, you guessed it, Ian Fleming, the author of the James Bond series. So Ian Fleming told JFK, said, I think you'll like my books, in so many words. And JFK did love them and told the nations, you should give these books a chance. So I always joke, you know, that Daniel Craig and his fellow actors portraying James Bond should send the Kennedy estate a thank you note for having helped to make the Bond franchise into the international behemoth that it is today.
Do you have a line or two to say about any of the most modern presidents, Nixon, both Bushes, Obama, Trump, or now Joe Biden?
Yeah, I mean, look, some presidents are readers. The nation would wait anxiously every year for Barack Obama to publish his recommended readings. And it's very clear that Barack Obama was a very serious and thoughtful reader of literature. Then, of course, on the other spectrum, you have Donald Trump, who openly says that he's not a reader, and that's public record. So, you know, you get the whole gamut. Recently, as you did historically, for every FDR, for every Abraham Lincoln, there was like the likes of Warren Harding, who was rated as a terrible president historically and also considered one who wasn't fond of books. So there's this sense of huge discrepancies throughout the presidency of those who are book people and those who are not book people.
Here's the bottom line. Are great readers also great leaders? Is that a fair conclusion to reach?
It's a very good question, Stephen. It's sort of the proverbial 800-pound monster in the room. And I've thought a lot about this because that's where I sort of started my research was, is there a connection between good reading and good leading. And I believe that there is. I think Harry Truman, who was a very fine reader and came to power at a very difficult time after World War II, Truman said, look, not all readers are leaders, but all leaders are readers. So I think the first thing that reading does is it shows your curiosity and your spirit of collaboration. The second thing I think reading does, it shows your humility as well. When you open a book, you're basically admitting that the world has something to teach you, that you are open to new ideas. And I think that's sort of an allegory for being open to the input of other people in your organization. So it's a wonderful kind of sign, I think. I've talked about reading as an act of curiosity and collaboration, an act of humility. But ultimately, I think its greatest gift for a leader is the perspective that it gives you. It allows you to see the world through other people's eyes. You know, I often speak with my students, you know, social media is more of a mirror. It reflects your interests back at you. Literature is this prism in which your ideas come into contact with those of others. It's like seeing the world with an additional set of eyes. And that, I think, is the most precious thing for a leader, to have the perspective of the people that he or she or they are meant to serve and to see the world through their eyes. I think literature gives you that extra set of eyes.
Joe, I got to tell you, if there's one thing you know how to do, it's end a talk. You're the best at it. Thank you so much for doing this.
This has been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us here at One Day University. Sign up at our website, onedayu.com, to become a member and access over 700 full-length video lectures from the world's finest professors. You can also download our app. There you can learn more about today's episode and watch Bard Professor Joseph Lucy's lecture on the President's Book Club, as well as his talks on celebrated authors like Edgar Allan Poe, Jane Austen, and many more. Join us next time when we preview King Charles' coronation.
Whenever there's one of these events, that criticism is made, like money could be spent in a better way. And Charles, I think he heard some of that, but at the same time, he wants his day in the sun.
One Day University is a production of iHeart Podcasts and School of Humans. If you're enjoying the show, leave a review in your favorite podcast app. You can also check out other Curiosity podcasts to learn about history, pop culture, true crime, and more.
School of Humans.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story. One passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.